Thank you. You can stay seated. That's fine. You can stay seated. Hey, it's so good to be back with you guys. I was here in the summer, and it was beautiful. I was surprised to see so many of you here and in the summer especially, because nobody goes to church in the summer, which is a miracle that there was anybody here. But it was great, and I'm honored to be back. And I've got a message, as Sten said, that I think is relevant for all of us today. And so a few months ago, I was able to get back to where I'm originally from, which is in Ohio, Southwest Ohio. I grew up there. And when I go back, I like to visit with my family there. And I've got two sisters. And between those two sisters, they have a collection of six children with their husbands. And so it's important for me to get my daughter, Gianna, back every so often so that she can get to know her cousins. But maybe more importantly, I like to get back in order for me to reinforce the narrative that Uncle Jamie is the coolest guy on the planet. So I like to get back and let them know how cool I still am. And so this last trip, I was able to take that narrative to a whole nother level. Now, the first night that I was there, we were hanging out at one of the sisters' houses, and they brought out this little box that I had heard about, but I had not actually seen in the wild. It was a little miniature video game system. And I'd heard about these little miniature video game systems, but I had never seen one. But what I had heard is that they contained in this little box all of the old school Nintendo games, that they had it on there. So the kids, they booted it up and they were taking turns playing the original Nintendo game, the best video game of all time, Super Mario Brothers. They were playing this game, and they were absolutely terrible at it. They were horrible. They couldn't even get past the first level. And so not knowing if Uncle Jamie still had the skills that he had as a young lad, Uncle Jamie said, "Hey guys, can Uncle Jamie take a turn here?" And so they handed me the second controller, and friends, it was on like Donkey Kong. Except it wasn't Donkey Kong, it was Super Mario Brothers. And so I worked my way through World 1, Point 1 and World 1.2, and I went to the secret area and warped to World 4, and they were like, "Uncle Jamie, how did you know about the secret warp?" And I'm like, "I'm Uncle Jamie, I know these things." And so I completed 4.1 and I completed 4.2, and then I found the secret beanstalk that took me to World 8, right? And they're like, "Uncle Jamie, you're amazing. And so a few more levels, then I got to the final stage, and boom! Uncle Jamie saves the princess. In like two tries, I saved the princess. And like within in unison, the nieces and nephews were crying out, "Uncle Jamie, you're our hero. Uncle Jamie, we're who we want to be, or you're who we want to be when we grow up. Uncle Jamie, you're a Nintendo god." And I'm like, "I'm Uncle Jamie. Of course, this is how Uncle Jamie is." Now, as I was like sitting there in front of that little monitor, I had like two revelations in that moment. As I was in front of that little bitty screen playing this game in front of my nieces and nephews just literally blowing their minds, two things became abundantly clear to me. The first one was this, is that my muscle memory is a powerful thing. Like literally, I have not played this game in 30 years. 30 years I hadn't picked up a controller. And like in two shots, I beat the whole game just from pure muscle memory. It was so much fun. That was the first shocking thing that occurred. The second aha that I had in this moment was simply this, that it has now become my turn. It's now become my turn to influence the next generation. It's now my turn. You see, I am who I am because of the family that came before me, what they did. I'm who I am today because of what they did, but now the family that's coming after me is going to be what they will be to some degree because of what I am doing right now for them. In other words, I am in the process of becoming someone else's previous generation. And guess what? So are you. You are who you are because of your family in the past. You know that. I know that. We know that, but this is also true. Your family in the future will be what it will be because of what you are doing right now. We are becoming someone else's previous generation. You and I are going to be a snapshot in someone's mind someday. Oh, yeah, I had a great aunt. Yeah, I remember her from when I was a little girl. That's going to be you. That's going to be you someday. Oh, yeah, I had that great grandpa. Yeah, I remember him. We used to wrestle in the living room. He was a smelly guy. Hopefully that won't be you, but it probably will be you. It'll probably be you. Oh, my uncle, he was the greatest uncle ever. Coolest guy on the planet. He was the best at Super Mario Brothers. You see, the reality is that you and I have a future family, and you and I are currently in the process of making our mark on them. What you're doing right now is going to impact the next generation. It's going to happen. The issue isn't if you will influence them, but how you will influence them. And so we want to figure out how to influence them in a positive way today. And so we're going to look at an example, in fact, I believe might be one of the best examples of how we can impact, how we can make a difference, not just in our life, but for generations to come. And so it's through the guy named Joseph. He is an Old Testament character who gives us a vivid example in his life of how we do this well. So if you brought a Bible today, or you have one on your app, I would encourage you to open up to Genesis chapter 42. Genesis chapter 42. If you didn't bring one with you today, I'm going to put the verses on the screen and you can follow along this way. So if you're new to church, let me just tell you a little bit about who this Joseph guy is. Joseph was one of 12 brothers, which on the surface doesn't sound like that big of a deal. I mean, there are a lot of Amish families and Catholic families that large. But what made this particular situation unique is that all of the brothers came from four different baby mamas, okay? Now, for other reasons than his polygamy, Joseph's dad, Jacob, was a horrible father. He was horrible. He was a horrible dad, a bad dad. And one of the reasons for that is that he ranked his kids. He ranked his kids. And Joseph, the guy we're going to be looking at today, Joseph was his favorite child because he was the kid from his favorite wife. How many of you guys have a favorite wife? No, don't answer this. It's not one you answer, all right? Now, just kidding. Of course you have a favorite wife. You can't love the one you want, love the one you're with, right? It's in the Bible somewhere, I think. Just kidding. Now, to demonstrate Jacob's affection for his favorite son, Joseph, Jacob bought, not Donny Osmond, but bought Joseph this amazing technicolored dream coat. And that act, in addition to some other things, it made the brothers of Joseph very angry with Joseph, so much so that they were willing to kill him. They wanted to kill him, but only later relented and simply sold him into slavery. They did that as a group of brothers. They sold their brother into slavery. And so we don't have time to go into the whole story today, but Joseph ends up in Egypt, and the drama doesn't stop there. But what I find absolutely fascinating is that from Genesis 39 to 41, we see God supernaturally positioning Joseph to save the entire nation of Egypt from an unexpected famine. But during that same time frame, 39 to 41, we don't hear a peep about Joseph's people. We don't hear a peep about Joe's kinfolk. We don't hear anything about his brothers or his family until we get to Genesis chapter 42, where they show up again on the scene. This time, though, the tables have turned. Where the last time we saw them, they were selling Joseph into slavery on the borderline of killing him. The last time we saw them, they were doing that. Now, the brothers are in Egypt to buy some food for their families. And as they are in Egypt, they unknowingly find themselves bowing down before Joseph, who is now the prime minister of the whole nation. And these brothers who were once about to kill him, but instead sold him into slavery, are now begging him to do something to save their lives. And as Joseph reflects on this scene, this turn of events, it seems strangely familiar. He's seen this scene before. And so here's what's happening in this moment of deja vu. Genesis chapter 42, verse 5 says this. So Jacob's sons This is Joseph's brothers. Jacob's sons arrive in Egypt along with others to buy food, for the famine was in Canaan as well. Verse 6, since Joseph was governor of all Egypt, he was essentially the prime minister, and he was in charge of selling grain to all the people, it was to him, to Joseph, that his brothers came. When they arrived, they bowed down before him with their faces to the ground. And even though they didn't recognize him, Joseph recognized his brothers instantly. Dun, 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 right? I mean, that's where we are in this story. Because Joseph here is not a 17-year-old kid anymore. He's 39 years old. It has been 22 years since he last saw his brothers. The brothers, remind you, that wanted to kill him. It's been 22 years since he's seen them. And now here they are. There they are, right there. Not only are they there, they're bowed down before him in this posture that's defenseless, vulnerable, just almost ready for Joseph to exact his revenge on them. And since they don't recognize him, they wouldn't even know what was coming. And so Joe's got him right where he wants him. And the question that Joseph has to deal with in this very moment is this: what do you do? What do you do when you have the power now to settle the score? What do you do when, because circumstances have changed and now you're in charge, what do you do when you have the ability to get revenge on those who have hurt you? Because now in this story, he's not a 17-year-old defenseless kid anymore. He is the prime minister of Egypt, and in one moment can snap his fingers and absolutely annihilate them. With one word or one snap of his fingers, he can put them into slavery as they were seeking to do to him. With one word, with one snap of his fingers, he could throw them in prison and no one would ever see them again. All it would take is for Joseph to say one word, to snap his fingers, and their lives would be completely destroyed, just like they tried to destroy his life 22 years ago. What do you do when you've got the power now to settle the score? And I imagine in that moment, Joe remembers exactly how they tried to hurt him, how they tried to ruin him. I'm sure he remembers their voices as he sat trapped in the bottom of the pit, in the bottom of the cistern, not knowing what they're planning to do with him, thinking that they're probably going to kill him. I'm sure he remembers the smiles and the laughs as they were selling him into slavery to some Midianite traders. I'm sure he remembers the clinking of the silver coins as the brothers were paid for his freedom. I'm sure he remembers the total lack of concern that they had for him on that day. And I'm sure he remembers all the reasons that he now would be justified in settling this score. But that time that he remembers 22 years ago when they tried to ruin his life, I think that's not the only moment that Joe remembers at that point. You see, I think he also remembers something else that he has seen, a specific scene from his childhood. And when he remembers this moment as well, and he begins to connect the dots to that moment, it becomes this moment of deja vu. But it also, as he remembers it, becomes a moment that guides him and shows him what he should do. But to see this moment from his childhood, we've got to go back in time a little bit to see what happened. We actually have to go back one entire generation and look at the life of Joseph's dad, Jacob, and Joseph's uncle, a guy by the name of Esau. In order to understand this other thing that Joseph remembers, we have to go back and look at what happened between Jacob and Esau, Joseph's dad and Joseph's uncle. And we don't have time to go into the entirety of this story, but starting in Genesis chapter 25, there's this couple of strange encounters where Joseph's dad, Jacob, stole everything from Joseph's uncle, Esau. We see these two situations where Jacob robs everything from his brother. Through his cunning and deception, Jacob is literally able to strip Esau of his entire inheritance. Jacob, Joseph's dad, is able to literally steal all the authority as the next head of the family from Esau and Esau's future position as boss in the family business. Essentially, Jacob, Joseph's dad, gets his brother Esau, Joseph's uncle, kicked out of the whole family, kicked out completely. Esau is out. He is out of money. He is out of authority. He's out of favor with the father. And so now Esau, Joseph's uncle, he abhors his brother Jacob for what he did. Genesis 27:41 says, "From that time on, after he was kicked out, Esau hated Jacob. And Esau began to scheme, 'I will soon be mourning my father's death. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.'" Esau's thinking to himself, "My dad's about to die. When my dad dies, I'm going to kill Jacob. I'm going to kill him. And I'm going to get back what was rightfully mine. And then Jacob, my horrible brother, he'll get exactly what he deserves." And so as a result of this impending death sentence, Jacob, Joseph's dad, he flees the scene before his father dies. And for the next 20 years, Jacob stays in hiding. He's off the grid. And it was during those two decades that Jacob finds his four baby mamas and has 11 kids, one of those being Joseph. But it was also during that time that he wasn't just getting busy making babies, he was also getting busy making money. Mucho dinero, cabbage, cheddar, stacks, G's, Benjamins, bills, big ones, bank. He was busy making babies and making money as well. He was becoming increasingly and incredibly wealthy. Now, it was after this 20-year exile that God speaks to Jacob. He speaks to Joseph's dad, and he tells him to do the unthinkable. Genesis chapter 31, verse 3 says this, "Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your father and grandfather,'" look at this, "'and to your relatives there,'" including Esau. "'But don't worry about that, because I will be with you.'" Now, no doubt, Jacob would have said in this moment, "God, you'd better be with me. You better be, if this is what you're asking me to do, you better be with me, because if Esau is the same Esau I ran away from 20 years ago, not only will he kill me, when I meet up with him, he's going to kill all my sons as well, and he's going to take my wives as his wives. Not only that, Esau's going to take all of my property, and when he sees all the wealth that I'm bringing back home, it's going to be more than he can handle. Esau will inevitably say to himself, 'At last, God has vindicated me because my deceiver of a brother, Jacob, is actually bringing back to me all the wealth that he stole from me as a kid.'" Now, this is a predicament, if there ever was a predicament. And what's happening here in that family, everybody would have known what was happening or what was about to happen. Because Jacob's whole family would have known what this whole situation meant for them. They all knew the risk of going back home. They all knew the relationship, the tense relationship between Jacob and Esau. They all knew, Jacob's whole family knew, that going back would probably be a death sentence for them. And I can almost imagine Joseph looking up to his dad, Jacob, and asking him, "Daddy, are we going to go see Uncle Esau?" "Yeah. Isn't that dangerous?" "Extremely. Is he going to kill us?" "Probably. But God says we've got to go back." So Jacob obeys. He packs up everybody and everything, and he heads back home. And Esau hears that they are coming. So he decides to send a welcome wagon their way. Genesis 33:1 says this, "Then Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming with his 400 men." Now, these were not the uncles of the family coming to swap stories. These 400 men were an army. Esau is coming to meet his brother with an army. So Jacob's got a plan. So he divides the children among Leah, his second favorite wife, Rachel, his favorite wife, and the two servant wives. And so his plan is simply this. I'm going to put my least favorite wives up front, and then my second favorite wife behind, and then my favorite wife in the back. So that if Esau's men come and start slaughtering people, my favorite wife and her kid can run off. What a noble guy, right? And that's what he does. He put the servant wives and their children in front, Leah and her children next. And now, I want to stop here because as I've been preparing for this message, the next five words jumped out at me in a way that I had never noticed before, completely floored me. And I want to show you these words. I want to show you the rest of the sentence. He put the servant wives and the children in front, Leah and the children next. And here it is. And Rachel and who? Joseph last. He put Rachel and Joseph last. Now, what's unique about these five words is that Joseph is the only one of the 11 brothers that were mentioned by name here. And it's important, I think, that we notice that he is clearly mentioned here because the author of this account wants to make sure that we know that Joseph saw what happened next. And so what happened next? Genesis 33:3 says this, "Then Jacob went on ahead. As he approached his brother, he bowed down." Sound familiar? "He bowed down to the ground seven times before him. Then Esau ran to meet him and" what? "Not struck him." He ran to meet him and not got revenge, not got even, not killed him. "Then Esau ran to him and embraced him, threw his arms around his neck, and kissed him. And then they both wept." You see, I submit to you today that Joseph is mentioned specifically by name here because we need to know that Joseph specifically had a front row seat to this specific situation. The situation between Jacob and Esau, two brothers. And I'm sure that Joseph never forgot what happened on that day. I'm sure he never forgot what he saw that day because that day, that reuniting, that day was the day that Joseph did not die. That day, that reuniting, was the day that his family did not die. And most shockingly, that is the day that his dad did not die. You see, I think Joseph would never forget the day that he saw Esau, his uncle, spare his brother's life. And then on that day, there was a reconciliation that no one expected and no one deserved. Now, fast forward 30 years later, and here stands Joseph with his brothers spread out, bowing down before him with their faces to the ground. And now Joseph has the power of life and the power of death in his hands. And what does he do? In that moment, Joseph chooses to do for his brothers what he saw his uncle do for his brother, Joseph's dad, Jacob. And just like Uncle Esau, Joseph let his brothers live. He gives them mercy, even though they didn't deserve mercy. Now, if you follow the story a little bit further, what you see is that Joseph reveals himself eventually to his brothers. They didn't know it was him, but he reveals himself, and he says to them, listen, guys, you may not recognize me. I may walk like an Egyptian. I may talk like an Egyptian, but I'm really a Hebrew. I am really your family. I am your long-lost brother. And in the midst of that moment, on that day, there was a reconciliation that no one expected and no one deserved. You see, Joseph knew what to do for his brothers by watching how his uncle responded to his dad. And so today, mid-current, here's the big idea. It's simply this. That our actions, they don't just speak louder than words. Sometimes our actions echo into the next generation. Our actions, they don't just speak louder than words. Sometimes they ripple into, sometimes they reverberate into, echo into the next generation. You see, what your children, what your grandchildren, what your nieces, what your nephews, what they see you do in hard situations, what they see you do in hard situations, that will lay the groundwork for what they do when they face similar situations in their lives as well. What they see you do when you respond to various struggles in your life, that's what they're going to mirror as well. I mean, you know this, I know this. They're going to forget about everything that we say. True. But they will never forget who you were and what you did when doing the right thing was the difficult thing to do. They will never forget that. They will never remember what you say, but they will remember who you were and what you did. Doing the right thing was hard to do. Our actions, they do speak louder than words, but they also echo. They echo into the next generation. And so what I want us to do in our few moments we have left together today is just to consider and think about our echo. What is our life saying to those who are watching our lives all around us? And so I'm going to ask you just to go ahead and close your eyes and bow your heads. And I'm just going to ask a few questions, a few guiding questions for you to think about the echo that you are having in the lives of those around you. Just in this moment, just between you and God, just to consider the life that you are building today. So dads, grandfathers, uncles, let me ask you, what if what you do in your life, what if what you do is the thing that your sons and grandsons and nephews take their cue from? What if it's you that they're looking to as their pattern of behavior? What if you are the role model for how they treat their future wife? What if you are the model for how they raise their kids? For how they raise your grandkids? What if you are the model for how they deal with extraordinary temptation in their lives in this culture? What if you are the model for how they respond to the crisis they have in their lives? Dads, grandfathers, uncles, what if they take their cue from you? You see, odds are they will. So moms, grandmas, aunts, let me ask you, What if your daughters, your granddaughters, your nieces, what if they take their cues from you for how they treat or how they talk to or how they respond to their future husband? What if they take their cue from you for how they will raise their children, your grandchildren? What if they look to you to figure out how they are going to view things like money or success or beauty or their body? Moms, grandmothers, aunts, what if you are their role model for how they understand their relationship with God? What if the life that we are all building right now will influence how our future family decides to build their life? What if what you're doing right now will determine what the next generation will eventually do in their life? Because the truth is, you are helping to decide that. You will guide that. And although you probably won't be able to see or be around to see the full implications of your actions, that doesn't mean that it's not important. The reality is, their decisions will be made with the imprint of your life in their mind. See, actions don't just speak louder than words. Sometimes they echo, sometimes they reverberate, sometimes they ripple into the next generation. So the question for us today is simply this: what will echo out of your life and into the next generation? Asking that question is so important. Answering it is so powerful, because whatever you want to echo out of your life someday is something you can start building into your life right now. Because you can make the best decision now. You can respond to temptation now. You can get the help you need now. You can start managing your money now. You can respond to relationship issues now. And when you do, your actions will reverberate into your future family, into the next generation. Whatever you need to start building into your life, whatever you need to do, you need to do it now. So will you? So will you? I pray that you will. The next generation is depending on what you decide to do right now.